In chapter 14, we'll be covering renal pathology. Let's start off talking about one congenital abnormality of the kidney, renal agenesis, especially bilateral renal agenesis. That's the one they like to ask about. It's also known as Potter syndrome. Clinically, these patients tend to present with oligohydramnios. Why? Because remember, the kidney is responsible for producing all of the amniotic fluid. Without any kidneys, they tend to develop oligohydramnios. These children tend to have very characteristic facies. They call them Potter's facies. They have flat nose, low-set ears, and recessed chins. Those are characteristic. The feet are also tend to be tucked under and sort of pushed upwards and in. It looks like the shape of a horse's tail. They call that tapis aquinovarus. The other severe problem with not having enough amniotic fluid is that the lungs do not develop well. They develop pulmonary hypoplasia. And as a result, Potter syndrome is usually incompatible with life. Let's move on to talk about cystic disease. Two major forms. There's the autosomal dominant and the autosomal recessive type. Start with the autosomal recessive type first. This is the childhood type. It's autosomal recessive. It usually presents in infancy. It's often progressive, and the patients will present with renal failure. Grossly, both kidneys will be enlarged, and they will contain numerous small cysts. And I want you to triple star this. The cysts have a very characteristic appearance. They tend to be oriented in a radial fashion, with their long axis at right angles to the capsule. Very characteristic appearance. Very few other things look like that. Last thing I want you to remember is that these kids do very poorly. They tend to die of renal failure. They can also have some other associated lesions. They can develop congenital hepatic fibrosis and multiple cysts within the liver as well. Let's next talk about autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. Fairly common. It's about 1 in 1,000 individuals. You should know the genetics. It's autosomal dominant. There is a mutation in the PKD1 gene. It's on chromosome 16. It involves a gene which produces a protein called polycystin-1. Now, on the exam, they tend to give you a patient who's in their middle ages. They present with renal insufficiency. They could have some hematuria, hypertension as well. The other clinical finding is when you do an abdominal exam, they tend to have bilateral abdominal masses. They can also have flank pain as well because these masses get huge. And finally, most of these patients will go on to develop end-stage renal failure. To make the diagnosis, it's pretty easy. You just need to visualize the kidneys either through ultrasound or CT. You'll see numerous huge cysts throughout both the cortex and the medulla of both kidneys. In fact, these kidneys become huge. And I want to show you a photograph of some of the typical findings. First of all, both kidneys are involved. It's a bilateral disease. These kidneys are massive. They develop very, very large sizes. And you see cysts that are also very large in size. The cyst may contain clear fluid, the fluid may be yellow, or it may also contain some hemorrhage. Okay, last thing I'd like to ask about for adult polycystic kidney disease are some of the extra renal manifestations. These patients can also develop cysts in the liver, they can develop perianeurysms of the circle of Willis, they can develop mitral valve prolapse, and finally, they're predisposed to developing colonic diverticuli. How do these patients do? They usually do pretty well. We can put them on renal dialysis, and then we can get them a renal transplant. Next, we're going to move into the glomerular diseases and talk about the glomerulonephritides. Before we talk about the individual diseases, I want to give you some general rules. Now, how are you going to handle this problem on the exam? Well, they got to give you two big pieces of information. The first is going to be the clinical syndrome. What do I mean? Well, if you take a look at table number 14.1, we classify the glomerular diseases into two syndromes, nephritic versus nephrotic syndrome. For the nephritic syndrome, they tend to have the following findings. They'll have hematuria. In fact, they may even see red cell casts in the urine. They have hypertension. They have azotemia, oliguria, and they can have some proteinuria as well, but it's almost always less than 3.5 grams a day. That is in contrast with the nephrotic syndrome. By definition, nephrotic syndrome, you will see a severe proteinuria. In fact, they tend to lose more than 3.5 grams a day of protein, mostly albumin. Now, because they're losing albumin in their peripheral blood, they have low levels of albumin, they develop generalized edema, and they can actually develop anasarca, severe generalized edema as well. Two other findings, they can develop lipiduria and hyperlipidemia as well. Now, why is it important to divide them into nephritic versus nephrotic? Well, the reason is it limits your differential. There's about five diseases that fall in the nephritic category. There are three diseases that fall in the nephrotic category. So right away, just based on the clinical history, it narrows your differential. The other piece of information they usually give you on the exam is the results of the renal biopsy. If you ever see one of these biopsies done, basically they inject a needle into the kidney, remove a toothpick-shaped biopsy. It's long and looks very cylindrical like a toothpick. Next thing we do is we divide that biopsy into three pieces. The first piece we send for light microscopy. We're going to look under the microscope. The second piece we send to the immunofluorescence lab, where they'll take fluorescent antibodies and apply it to the glomerulus. The last piece you send to the EM lab, where they'll do electron microscopy. Now, why are we doing immunofluorescence and electron microscopy? Well, many of these kidney diseases are caused by antibodies, either direct antibody injury or, more likely, immune complexes, which circulate and deposit in the kidney. One of the great ways to detect these immune complexes is to do immunofluorescent microscopy or electron microscopy. So that's what you're looking for IF and EM. Okay, let's go through each of the diseases in the nephritic category first. And remember, you got to use the clinical history plus the biopsy findings to make the diagnosis. Okay, the first one in this category is called acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. The other synonyms are acute proliferative or post-infectious glomerulonephritis. Clinically, they will usually give you a child who's just had a throat infection with streptococcus. That's characteristic. And then two to four weeks later, they start presenting with blood in the urine. Usually they describe it as being smoky urine. It's a classic description. The organism that's responsible for this is beta hemolytic group A streptococcus. Although I want you to remember, it can be associated with other bacteria, other viruses, and other systemic diseases as well. Clinically, they'll have all the nephritic signs and symptoms. In the laboratory, there will be evidence of the strep infection. Basically, you'll see elevated levels of the ASO titers. You'll also see low levels of complement. Why? Because you're going to have immune complexes being formed. The antibodies that were supposed to be against the strep are now forming immune complexes and depositing in your glomeruli. They're causing complement to become activated. So complement levels tend to go down. Okay, now for each of these diseases, I want you to pay close attention to light microscopy, immunofluorescence, and EM. And I'll show you which ones that are most likely to show you on the exam. For this one, light microscopy is not very specific. The glomeruli tend to be hypercellular. You'll see neutrophils. You'll see monocytes. You could see some red cells in some of the tubules. It's not really specific. The board won't usually show you that picture. What they like to show, though, is the immunofluorescence and the EM, so I would star those. For immunofluorescence, you will see granular deposits within the glomeruli, and the granular deposits are being highlighted by an antibody. It's usually an IgG or IgM antibody. for electron microscopy. Again, you'll see immune complexes. They tend to occur in a subepithelial location. And they tend to be two sizes. You'll have small deposits and you'll have huge deposits. The huge deposits basically looks like a camel hump, so they call them subepithelial humps. It's just a descriptive term. Now, how do you treat these patients? It's usually conservative because most kids do excellently. In fact, 95% will have complete recovery. About 1% will go on to more aggressive diseases like rapidly progressive crescentic glomerulonephritis or chronic glomerulonephritis, basically end-stage renal disease. Adults, they don't do quite as well. Only 60% will have complete recovery. 40% go on to other diseases. Okay, the next disease in the nephritic category is good pastures, also known as anti-GBM disease. You got to remember the pathogenesis. You are producing autoantibodies against the basement membrane, specifically against collagen type 4 in the basement membrane. This results in damage in two locations in the body. So clinically, they're going to have problems with the lungs and problems with the kidneys. So look at the clinical features. It tends to be more common in males, usually in their late 20s and early 30s. How will they present? Usually the pulmonary problems present first. So they'll come in with recurrent episodes of hemoptysis, followed by renal manifestations. That's the classic presentation. Let's look at the light microscopy, electron microscopy, and immunofluorescence. Light microscopy is not specific, but many of these cases will go on to crescentic glomerulonephritis, so you may see some crescents. For EM, again, not specific, you'll see some disruption of the glomerular basement membrane. For this disease, I want you to triple star immunofluorescence. They love to show a photograph of that. And what will it look like? It looks like a smooth and linear pattern. People describe it as looking like a neon sign. So to be smooth and linear, you can just follow it around the glomerulus. And it usually stains positively with antibodies to IgG or C3. Now, how do you treat these patients? Well, they've got antibodies circulating in their serum. So there's a couple things you can do. You can do plasma exchange. Take their plasma out, replace it with other plasma. Another thing you can do is you can give them steroids. Try to decrease the production of these antibodies. Finally, what's the prognosis? It's usually pretty poor. They can die from the pulmonary hemorrhages. If they don't die from those, they tend to go on to renal failure. They develop crescentic glomerulonephritis. Okay, the third disease in the nephritic category is rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis, also known as crescentic. The clinical feature is you're going to have a rapid progression to renal failure. It occurs very quickly, over a span of like weeks to months. It occurs in a couple of different clinical settings. It can occur after good pastures, as we just mentioned. It can follow other diseases. Remember, like 1% of post-streptococcal can go on to this form. It can also be associated with vasculitides, like Wegener's. And finally, I want you to remember about 50% of cases are idiopathic. We have no idea what caused them. Let's look at the light microscopy. This is where the money is. On light microscopy, in crescentic glomerulonephritis, you expect to see crescent formation. It's one of the few times the pathologist becomes romantic under the microscope. Okay, because you see these crescent moons within Bowman space. In the past, they love to ask you, what is the composition of these crescents? And you should remember that they are composed of fibrin, a proliferation of parietal epithelial cells, and an influx of monocytes and macrophages. What's the prognosis for rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis? Well, it's pretty poor. Usually you go on to renal failure in most cases. The fourth disease in the nephritic category is IgA nephropathy, also known as Berger's disease. Clinically, this is the most common glomerulonephritidy in the world. In fact, on the exam, the patients usually come from either France, Japan, or Italy. usually affects young adults most commonly. It's usually males. And the presentation is not only do they have nephritic, but they usually have gross hematuria. And let me tell you, nothing brings you to the doctor quicker than having red pee. Okay? That's class presentation. Now, we think it may be associated with a virus because a lot of these cases follow a respiratory infection. And the last thing I want you to remember is that it is associated with other IgA diseases like celiac sprue and Henoch-Schönlein purpura. Let's look at the light microscopy. You will see a proliferation of the mesangial region. Why? Because all these IgA antibodies and these immune complexes are being deposited in the mesangial region, so it gets thicker. You see a mesangial proliferation. The thing I want you to star, though, is the immunofluorescence. They like to show the immunofluorescence. Again, you will see a granular pattern, but this time it will be staining with IgA. It's the only one with immunofluorescence with IgA. Okay. Finally, the electron microscopy, you will see immune complexes. They're usually in the mesangial region. Prognosis. These patients do pretty well. Many of the cases, though, over a long period of time, like 20, 25 years, ultimately go to renal failure. That brings us to the last member of the nephritic category, and probably the most confusing for students. It's the membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis. Now, there are two forms. There's type 1 and there's type 2. Type 2 is known as dense deposit disease. Now, why is this a hard one? Well, look clinically. Most of the time it's nephritic, but it can also be nephrotic. It can be mixed. So clinically, it's hard for them to give you a question about this one. But what can they ask? Well, they can ask you the following. Look at the laboratory findings. Patients with type 2 tend to produce a unique antibody. They call it C3 nephritic factor. So that's one thing they can ask about. Next thing they can ask you about is under light microscopy. The glomeruli tends to have a lobulated appearance. There's a mesangial proliferation. And the last thing you'll see is splitting of the basement membrane. They call that TRAM tracking. TRAM tracking. It's best seen with silver stains or PAS stains. And why is the basement membrane being split apart? Well, it's because of the mesangial proliferation. It's proliferating. It's sending its process into the basement membrane, splitting it apart. Now you've got two rails of a train or a tram tracking. Okay. What else can they ask about? Well, immunofluorescence, not specific. The thing about that is they tend to have a granular pattern. It's usually stains with C3. Electron microscopy. For type 1, you'll see immune complex deposits in a subendothelial location. For type 2, you actually see dense deposits within the basement membrane. What's the prognosis? It tends to have a very slowly progressive course, and over many years, 10 to 15, they develop renal failure. All right, let's continue now with the primary glomerulopathies. Let's talk about the nephrotic syndrome. There are three major diseases in this category. The first is membranous glomerulonephritis. This is the most common cause of the nephrotic syndrome in adults. Let's look at the etiology. The majority of cases are idiopathic, but in some cases we do know the cause. For instance, it is associated with drugs. It's associated with infections, especially hepatitis. It's associated with systemic diseases like lupus and diabetes mellitus. It's also associated with various cancers, and there may be a genetic predisposition as well. Let's look at the light microscopy. Now, this is a board favorite. They love membranous. Why? Because they can test you on light microscopy, EM, and IF. It's all fair game. So let's start with light microscopy. There tends to be a very diffuse membrane-like thickening of all the capillary walls. The other thing you'll see is if you do a silver stain, you will see spiking of the basement membrane. Basically, little projections on the basement membrane, call them membrane spikes. Next thing they can give you is immunofluorescence. This has a granular and a linear pattern. It usually stains with IgG. It can also stain with C3 as well. Finally, they can give you electron microscopy. This will have immune complex deposits in a subepithelial location along the basement membrane. Now, prognosis tends to be variable. Some patients will have spontaneous remission. Some patients will have persistence of proteinuria. Some patients will go on to end-stage renal disease. The next disease in this category is minimal change disease. The other names for this is lipoid nephrosis or Nil's disease. Now, for the clinical features, I want you to remember this is the most common cause in children of the nephrotic syndrome. So it tends to be kids, usually ages 2 to 6 years of age. And finally, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. Let's look at the light microscopy. Well, they call this Nil disease or minimal change disease because there's not a lot of changes. In fact, the light microscopy looks normal. Guess what? The immunofluorescence also looks normal. There's no immune complexes, so it doesn't highlight anything. It's normal. The only thing that is abnormal and they can potentially test you on is the EM. On EM, there are no immune complexes, but what you will see is you will see effacement of the foot processes of the podocytes or epithelial cells. Basically, they become fused or lost. Okay, how do you treat it? You treat it usually with steroids. And the good news is in most kids, they have an excellent prognosis. Most will respond to steroids. The last primary disease in the nephrotic category is called focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. This is more common in African Americans. It occurs in all ages. And again, it gives you the nephrotic syndrome. Let's look at the etiology. It can be idiopathic. It can be due to a loss of renal tissue. It could be superimposed on other glomerulonephritides, such as IgA nephropathy. And the three I want you to circle is if they give you a patient with sickle cell, heroin abuse, or AIDS, and they ask you what's the most likely glomerulonephropathy, it is focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. Okay? Okay, for the microscopic, all the money is on the light microscopy. For that, you will see focal segmental sclerosis and hyalinization of the glomeruli. So typically what you'll see is it's a focal disease, meaning not all of the glomeruli will be involved. And also, the ones that are involved, not the whole glomerulus will be involved, only a segment of it. So focal segmental sclerosis. Okay, immunofluorescence is not really specific. You can see some immune complex deposits in the sclerotic areas. EMs, again, not specific. For treatment, tends to be very poorly responsive to steroids. And the big problem with this disease is if you give this patient a renal transplant, there's a high rate of recurrence in the transplanted kidney. For prognosis, children tend to do better than adults, but most of the time, the adults will go on to end-stage renal failure. Before I move on, the diseases we just talked about are the primary diseases, meaning that these diseases primarily affect the kidney. There are some other kidney diseases that are associated usually with systemic diseases that can fall in these categories. And the two I want to bring to your attention is in diabetes. Remember that diabetes, they develop what's called Kimmel-Still-Wilson's disease. Those patients will present with the nephrotic syndrome. Okay, but that one should be a give me because they're going to have to tell you that they have diabetes. Okay, the other one that can also present with the nephrotic syndrome is amyloid. If you develop amyloidosis of the kidney, they can present with the nephrotic syndrome. But again, they've got to give you some other history or Congo red stain for you to make the diagnosis of amyloid. Okay, now let's move on to end-stage renal disease. The term for this is chronic glomerulonephritis. This is the end stage or final form of many types of glomerular diseases. It's characterized by renal failure, uremia, and unfortunately, ultimately death. Clinical features. Well, without the kidneys, you don't have erythropoietin, so they tend to have anemia. They also tend to have a lot of hypertension, and they don't produce a lot of urine. Grossly, the kidneys are small, they're atrophic, they're shrunken. And if you did a biopsy, you would see that the glomeruli are basically sclerotic. They're all hyalinized and destroyed. Treatment is dialysis and ultimately renal transplantation. Okay, let's move forward and talk about tumors of the kidney. Let's talk about the benign tumors first. The first benign tumor is called a cortical adenoma. These are small benign tumors, very, very common finding at autopsy. The key thing is the size. They're usually less than 3 centimeters in size. They tend to be in the cortex. They tend to be encapsulated. The other benign tumor I want you to know about is called an angiomyolipoma. These are hamartomers. They're basically composed of fat, smooth muscle, and blood vessels that are all haphazardly arranged. The reason I want you to remember angiomyolipomas is it's associated with tuberous sclerosis. So keep that association in mind. Now let's talk about some malignant diseases of the kidney. The most common kidney tumor in an adult that's malignant is a renal cell carcinoma. The other term for these are hypernephromas. They're most common in older males. And for the risk factors, I want you to pay attention to cigarette smoking. That's a big one. The other big one is von Hippel-Lindau disease. For the gross, I'm going to illustrate it by using a photograph. Let's take a look at this photograph. This was the kidney. Let me outline it for you. I'll outline the kidney. Here it is coming around here. The kidney has been cut in half. Here's one half. Here's the other half. All this other yellow tissue surrounding it is all the perinephric adipose tissue. Now, here's the normal kidney. This huge yellow thing is what a renal cell carcinoma looks like. They tend to have a yellow appearance, and they tend to have areas of hemorrhage and necrosis as well, these hemorrhagic areas. Okay, they tend to be solitary. They also tend to occur in the upper pole of the kidney, like this one is. And finally, how does the tumor spread? Well, it tends to spread by hematogenous means, meaning that it will invade the renal vein. It could spread into the inferior vena cava. In fact, these tumors are notorious for actually snaking their way up into the right side of the heart. On the microscopic, these tumors tend to be clear-celled tumors. They tend to have polygonal-shaped cells, and the cytoplasm tends to be clear. That's the most common type. There are other types listed in your handout. The only other one I've ever seen them ask about is the sarcomatoid variant. They ask about this one because it has the worst prognosis, and it looks like a sarcoma, so you'll see spindle-shaped tumor cells. Now let's look at the clinical presentation and talk about the not-so-classic classic triad. This includes hematuria, a palpable abdominal mass, and flank pain. Now, this is only present in 10%, so I call it a not-so-classic classic triad. Now, the other thing I want you to remember for the boards is that these tumors are associated with paraneoplastic syndromes, just like lung tumors are. In fact, they can produce erythropoietin, you'll develop polycythemia. They could produce renin, you develop hypertension. They could produce PTH, you get hypercalcemia. And finally, they can produce ACTH, and you develop Cushing's. Okay, let's move on to the most common tumor of the kidney in children. Let's talk about Wilms' tumor, also known as a nephroblastoma. These tumors are most common in ages 2 to 5 years. The risk factors, they are associated with some genetic factors, like the Wegar syndrome. Wegar stands for Wilms' tumor, anarrhythmia, other genital anomalies, and mental retardation. You should also know the tumor suppressor genes, WT1 and WT2. Next, you should know that in kids, these tend to present as large abdominal masses. Grossly, they tend to be large, solitary, tan tumors. You should know the microscopic appearance. The microscopic appearance is composed of 3 different characteristic features. The first feature is you will see an immature cell. They call this blastema, also known as metanephric blastema. That's the first element. The second element is you'll see epithelial structures. So you may see immature glomeruli. You may see immature tubules. The final component is stroma. What is the treatment? The treatment is combination. You use surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. And the good news is these patients have an excellent prognosis. In fact, there's a 90% long-term survival rate for these patients. That will conclude chapter 14, renal pathology.